Good morning and welcome to Home Fires Radio Show. This morning, with me in the studio, I have a very special guest from abroad. His name is, how does the whole title, Visiting Distinguished Professor Louis Ray, is that?
Yes, exactly this.
Visiting Distinguished Professor. That's very impressive title. That comes with the terms of your invitation to come to the University of Alaska. Is that a title that you have at home, or is that a title that is associated with the University of Alaska? The visiting distinguished part, of course, the professor part is yours.
Well, I believe it's connected with my function in Fairbanks.
Uh-huh.
Of course, because I'm a visiting professor from abroad, and that's the reason why this term has been used. I must confess, it has been used for me in the past when I have been teaching, for instance, in Mexico and in Chile, too. But I'm happy to find it again because it has some, also some flavor of visiting friends, and I believe it's exactly what it is.
This time, how many trips have you made to Alaska? This is your...
Oh, I came to Alaska for the first time in 1974, and it was a very interesting visit, as usual, I must say. And I was with my wife, and we circled quite a lot. We were on the Bering Strait, we were in the Aleutian, we were also inland. We were already for the first time in Prudhoe Bay. Mm-hmm. Prudhoe Bay was just in the peak of construction of the line at that time. It was in the month of May, and I remember it was extremely cold.
Mm-hmm.
It was our first contact.
Yes. Stunningly cold for
exactly,
the month of May.
Exactly, with the Alaskan cold. And since this period, I had the chance to come back at least 10 times now to Alaska, so I feel more or less at home.
Yes, you're a commuter. A commuter from...
A long-distance commuter,
A long-distance commuter, nonetheless, from... Switzerland. You live in Switzerland.
I live in Switzerland. I am French, but I have been living now 21 years in Switzerland. And it's very close to my homeland because I was born in the French Alps, in fact, on the other side of the borderline.
Could I am actually, in the course of the stories that I have heard you tell, I'm really fascinated with the varied, diverse, adventurous life you've had. Could you give us a little bit about your background for the benefit of our listeners?
Oh, with great pleasure. You know, I started my studies during a difficult period, that means during the war. And during the war, it was not only difficult because food was not that available, transportation was not available. We had to go back home quite early in the evenings. We are under the pressure, of course, of foreign forces, and unfortunately, we were also under the bombing and into the movement of troops. So that was not always very easy to make studies at that time. I was in the college. Then after the war...
Where were you studying?
It was in Savoy, in the French Alps, in Chambéry.
Okay, during the Second World War.
And Savoy, yes, Savoy was, in fact, has been connected to France a bit over 120 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
It was before a part of the Kingdom of Italy. And we still have kept a lot of good relationship with our Italian neighbors.
I think many of, as dim as some of our European history may be, most people are familiar with the sort of variance that occurs along that French border, the Alsatian, the changes in Alsatian status and so on. So
that's true, with maybe a difference in the case of my homeland, is that instead of becoming French at the end of the last century by any kind of military process, it came to France in a very democratic way, that means by a popular vote.
Huh.
That means that they were asked,
choice.
Yes, whether the people would like to remain within the Kingdom of Italy or whether they would like to join France, and at this time they decided to go to the French side. But that does not prevent them to keep a very good and friendly relationship with their Italian colleagues. So then I went to make my university degree in Paris.
Mm-hmm.
I spent quite a number of years in Paris. I studied at the Sorbonne, and I graduated first as an MA and then later on as a PhD in physical chemical biology. And my main research area at that time was the effect of cold, of low temperatures on living organisms. So that goes from hypothermia, hibernation, to tissue banking, freezing, freeze-drying, preparation of blood samples, preparations of tissue cells for reconstructive and reparative surgery, and things of the like.
So that your interest in things that have very great application to the Arctic area started very early in your career.
Well, that's true. And I must say that in parallel with my studies, I started to visit the Arctic areas. I was in Upper Lapland as early as 1949. And I traveled to northern Norway. And each time I had an occasion to go north, I went north. That was certainly for me a quite specific attraction.
Mm-hmm.
Then I spent a few years at the National Research Council as a research fellow in charge of developing precisely techniques for the storage and preservation of tissues. The implication was quite important at that time. It was essentially to have tissue banks which could be used in case of emergency, for instance, like in a big mine accident,
mm-hmm.
or a major aircraft accident with a lot of people burned and things of the like. And I worked essentially on skin bank and the treatment of extended burns.
Mm-hmm.
And this, curiously enough, brought me into the military areas because of the Korea War, first, and second, because of the Algeria War. In both cases, there have been a lot of people injured and a lot of people burned. And I worked at that time very closely with the laboratory and the services of the tissue bank of the American Navy in Bethesda. And I came quite often to Washington to discuss problems of preserving tissue, crafting, and so on. And it had later on a rather important application in mines. And I was in charge of the tissue bank for the coal mines in between Germany, Belgium, and France, and for the treatment also of people who were burned. So this was a very challenging part of my career, and where I had already contact with different disciplines,
mm-hmm.
with physicians, with surgeons, with social workers, with the workers themselves.
And then with coal mines.
Exactly.
And you have the one thing that I have noted about you through the 2 years that I have known you is that you're very curious, and every time you hear something interesting, you sort of seize upon it and question what's going on here. So I can imagine that every time you found yourself in a new circumstance that you inquired as to all the parts of that operation. Does Europe have a lot of coal mines?
Yes, I did. Yeah.
And still?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. And what you are telling about my different fields of interest, I believe can be summarized in one single word. I'm interested in men. I'm interested in science, of course. I'm interested in history. I'm interested in technology. But as long as they are the direct manifestation of people.
Mm-hmm.
And behind all these technologies or behind all disciplines, I try and see what the people do. I'm interested in people, finally, and how they evolve, how they integrate themselves into the daily life, how they make their way in history, how they group into large countries or in smaller countries, what are their challenges, what are their future. And along those lines, of course, the Arctic is very interesting because it's an area in which people are in front of a very mighty and powerful nature. So they have to give the right measure of their possibilities. It's it's certainly an area in which they are directly challenged.
Yes, I think that one of the things that's so interesting about this area is that we have this sense that we're very isolated and very far away from other nations because it takes so long to get here. But in fact, if you look at a globe, if you look at us in that sense, this circumpolar region is we are very close to each other. Obviously, Little Diomede's very close to Big Diomede, and therefore the United States at this point is very close to Russia. But I think a lot of times just living your life, you don't have the sense of closeness with other people from other nations that is actually true.
Well, what you are telling, Betty, is absolutely true. And in fact, it's really something which was not immediately evident, because it's quite rare that the geographical maps which are used in school teachings are polar maps. And the distortion, which is done by the other type of mapping, gives the impression that the polar regions are spread along the whole length of the world.
Right.
In fact, it's an inside sea, the Arctic Ocean. I have called it in many publications a polar Mediterranean. It's an internal sea.
A polar Mediterranean.
Yes, because in fact from northern Canada, you are by far closer to USSR than you are from Ottawa.
Yes.
And from northern Alaska, you are also closer to Scandinavia than you are from Florida. So it's quite clear that there is some kind of a geographical intimacy, if I can say so, in between these different countries around the Central Sea.
Intimacy.
Intimacy, exactly.
Yes. You're right. When you described that map, I suddenly had this flash on the paper map in the atlas that has all these sort of weird divides with blank paper in between on the northern
exactly.
regions, which
exactly.
really gives us a sense of great distance at the top. In fact, we have much in common in that our environment is such a strong influence on the way we live our lives, perhaps more in common than the people who live around the equator.
Definitely so.
You know,
definitely so. Not only in physical distance, because you are closer, the one to the other, but also because of the special structure of the area as an internal sea. That means that all the countries are neighbors of finally the same water expense, and as such they share in common a certain number of problems, and they have to address this together in a coordinated way. What is a paradox of the Arctic region is that in fact it is the platform which is linking the two superpowers, the USSR and the United States. But it is also at the same time an enormous chessboard. And that this intimacy you were referring to is unfortunately cut in two by the Iron Curtain. On one side, it's a Warsaw Pact bloc. On the other side, it's a NATO and the NATO friends. So it's one of the big problems of the Arctic is the fact that there is definitely a close relationship between people, not only a geographical relationship, but a historical relationship, ethnographical relationship between the natives, for instance. And at the same time, they are just opposite because of different ideologies and different political structure. Is not it funny, for instance, to see that I met just 1 year ago in Anchorage one of our Russian colleagues who is working in Northeast Siberia. He's just very close to us. Mm-hmm. He's our close-by neighbor. You know, I have just to cross the Bering Strait, and he's a few hundred miles inside, which is nothing. And then to come to Anchorage, he went through Moscow and New York and all the way around in the other direction, just because he has a political bloc which prevent any of the Russian citizen to cross the Bering Strait going east.
So he must go all the way
absolutely.
Around so that he enters
the
right
the
door.
Sun.
The polite door.
The setting sun, sorry.
The polite door. He has
exactly.
to come through the front rather than the back.
Exactly.
The appropriate approach is always important. The inner sea, that sea is frozen a good part of the year and is not accessible in the normal water way. What effect does that have? Let me go back a little bit. When I heard a lecture that you gave last year, and for some reason this had not been very clear to me, you made the point that Russia has very little access to the water, that when you were talking about naval strategies. Mm-hmm. And there I think of Russia as this huge country, and suddenly it came clear to me that, in fact, you're right. They have a very different situation than the United States, where we have from sea to shining sea, which we all make frequent reference to. That is not the case.
No, and in fact, this is important for many reasons. First, the Arctic Ocean, which is an inland sea, Mediterranean in the true sense, a sea between lands, is almost completely closed and communicate with the other seas of the globe only through small passages, which are narrow and shallow, like the Bering Strait, the Canadian Arctic Archipelago channels, the Nares Strait between Greenland and Canada, and there is only one big passage, which is between Spitsbergen and Greenland, where the Atlantic waters can flow freely into the Arctic Ocean, and when, of course, as a counterpart, the cold water from the Arctic Ocean are moving southwards along Greenland. Now, that sea is very deep. In certain areas, it has more than 12,000, even close to 15,000 feet. A deep basin, central basin, even if it's surrounded by more shallow epicontinental seas with long shelves, like along the Soviet Union. But that sea is covered with permanent ice. And as such, it is not an open sea. That means it's a sea which is difficult because of the presence of, let's say, in between 2 to 4 meters of permanent ice flows on the surface. Now, if we consider the sea as a global geographical entity, that cover of ice is in fact negligible vis-à-vis the sea itself. It's a thin skin, nothing else, which is on the surface. Below, it's just liquid water as everywhere. But if we look now at the sea as a sea susceptible to have navigation and to receive ships and to be used for commercial or for transportation utilization, then, of course, it is a formidable barrier.
Mm-hmm.
And along those lines, until very recent times, no ships have ever been able to cross through the Arctic Sea, because that 2 to 4 meters of ice is just insurmountable. Recently, the Russians developed some nuclear-propelled icebreakers, the Arctica, the Sibir, the Brezhnev, who were able to fight their way to the pole, through the polar ice. Very mighty instruments. Now, we prefer today to use for this type of transpolar navigation submarines, which of course can swim easily under the ice, which explain also that the Arctic Ocean might be, in a way, a reservoir of all kinds of submarines from different opposing navies. Hence, its strategic importance. Now, what you said about Soviet Union comes directly from the presence of this Arctic ice. The Soviet Union has very limited access to the high seas, because all along its northern border, for more close to maybe 10,000-15,000 miles of coastline, it is just blocked by ice the year round. And in the south areas, the Russian territories are all bordering more or less internal seas, and they are bottled by straits. There, for instance, The Black Sea is bottled by the Turkish Straits. The Baltic is also closed by the Danish and the Swedish Straits. And the only access that the Russians have to the open sea is on the Far East, from Kamchatka, from Petropavlovsk, since Vladivostok also falls into the inland Japanese Sea and has to go through the Japanese Straits. And on the west, in the northern of Scandinavia, in the area of Murmansk, the Kola Peninsula.
But it's a fairly narrow...
And it's also a passage which is not that big, and which is squeezed in between two Norwegian territories, Spitsbergen and Finnmark.
So it can be fairly closely monitored.
It could be very closely monitored, and the Russians during all the last years have been harassed by this idea and very much preoccupied by the fact that they could be completely bottled inside their own territory. That's one of their problems of access for the high seas.
On the other hand, this ice cover, this thin skin of ice, as you describe it, has one real value. And I remember you saying that this is sort of complete protection from detection for nuclear missiles that may be on submarines, that it's a sort of hole in the detection system for us as well as for them. Is that... correct, or would you like to...
No, that's true. That's Arctic ice has many different consequences. And one of them is definitely that it builds a very difficult barrier between the underlying water and the atmosphere. And that barrier can be used as a screen. And of course, the nuclear-propelled submarine, which are operating into the Arctic Ocean, cannot be easily detected, because one of the way to detect a submarine is to follow at the surface the release of the warm waters which come from the engines. The nuclear engines need to be cooled, and they are cooled with the surrounding seawater. That water, of course, gets out warmer. As warmer, it's lighter in density. It comes to the surface, and it gives a long thermal plume which shows very easily the track of a submarine in depth in an open sea. And this from a spacecraft or from a high-altitude aircraft, it's very easy to see.
And since we have satellites now that are just regularly going around,
it's one of their duties, definitely so.
Pretty easy to track.
Sure. And the other way to detect a submarine at sea is to immerse from... at certain intervals, some sonobuoys on some acoustic detector and hear the noise made by the engine. And these engines are becoming more and more silent, but the propeller, anyhow, for a large ship, is making a given noise. And these given noise are of the spectral signatures. They identify with great precision the submarine, and all the navies can very well, know who is moving and where, by this detection. Now, in the Arctic Ocean, these two possibilities are excluded, because the warm water do come back to the surface, but they come back under the ice,
right.
And this is shielded by 2 or 4 meters of ice, and it's just impossible to see.
Satellites aren't going to be
able to help
us there.
And second, the acoustic detection is not easy too, because that ice is a skin, as I told you, it's very thin. And as such, it is moved continuously by the currents, by the winds, by the tide. It inflates and deflates twice daily. And thus, it collides, it drafts, and it has all kind of movement of this ice, pressure ridges which develop, and so, and this creates terrific noise.
It's very noisy out
very
there.
Noisy. And, of course, to detect the small noise of a nuclear propeller submarine in this is just impossible. It's completely covered.
It was such an amazing idea to me. The image, having seen films and so on of this sort of dark in the winter, ice deserted place, and suddenly I had this vision of this very populous, active under the ice population movement, something that has strategic value, that has real importance. It gives you a whole sort of under the surface impression of things that one might not consider at first. Energy. Energy is something that Alaskans are very aware of because our recent prosperity is based on the oil discoveries. This is something that, in fact, a lot of the circumpolar countries have in common, because we have in some areas thermal energy, here oil, some coal reserves in this area. Could you speak a little bit with us about sort of energy things that we have in common and what the future predictions are about how this will hold out?
Well, of course, energy is a very important topic because our world is using a terrific amount of energy, and it would be difficult to backtrack now. Energy is also very needed for the development of developing nations of the third world at the same time, as well as for our own advanced form of civilization. The energy resources of the Arctic areas are very important. I would not say that they are more important than other resources which can be found worldwide. I don't believe we can ever duplicate a structure like the Middle East. The Middle East for oil is an almost unique reservoir worldwide. But nevertheless, in the fossil fuel deposits in the northern territories are large, and they present a certain number of interests. The number one is that they are politically free, if I can say so. Those resources in Alaska, they belong to the United States, and the United States can make use of them without any constraint, except, you know, the own constraint that they wish to give to themselves. And the same goes for Canada. And to a certain extent, this would also apply to Norway. Whether it is well known with the different crises that we have lived in the energy field, that the Middle East resources, the African resources, and to a certain extent the South America resources, are under hard political pressure. And as such, they might be, I would not say unreliable, but difficult of access in periods of tensions. And it is quite clear also that they are far away, and that in the event of a war, the transport by sea becomes very hazardous. We have seen it during the last World War, and that as such, the United States or North America would be highly dependent upon the maintenance of their sea line of communication in wartime, which is something that nobody can guarantee for the transport of massive quantity. Yes, you can move warships because they defend themselves. You can move submarine, but to move major tankers and to channel billions of barrels of oil for an extended war from one place to another one is a big hazard. That's one of the very specific points of the NATO alliance. The NATO is an alliance which is split in two parts. It has a North American part with United States and Canada, and it has an eastern flank with Europe, northern Norway, and in between a large ocean. The big difference with Soviet Union, which has continuity, territorial continuity, for the whole Warsaw Pact. You can move from the Bering Strait down to Bulgaria, remaining on land all the way through. You can move from the area of Murmansk up to the Chinese border, still remaining on land. So it's not at all the same strategic issues. Mm-hmm. And for that reason, the development of national resources on the American soil was an absolute must. And I believe this was really one of the big points of developing of the Arctic resources.
Does the recent English discovery of oil in the Northern Seas, is that part of this whole same oil reserve?
Well,
geographically?
The British, well, in a way, yes. The British discovery of, and the Norwegian discoveries of oil into the Norwegian Sea or into the North Sea is, of course, part of this huge amount of fossil fuels which lay under the continental slope, under the continental shelf, in the submerged area of the seas on the periphery of continents. It has no geological continuity with the reservoirs which are in North America. But it has more or less the same origin and the same type of structure. And the techniques which are used to recover the oil in the North Sea are very similar to the techniques which could be used to recover the oil offshore Alaska, of course. It's always deep. It's at a few thousand meters in depth. And you need some specialized type of structure to have access to this. And one of the interesting features being that you have to exhaust or to use a reservoir from a limited space. I wish to make myself understood. When you have, like in the Middle East or in Africa, or even in USSR, a large field with massive oil deposits, and that field can extend over tens of miles, even sometimes more, you will be able to have access to the oil any place by drilling any number of wells you would deem desirable. So it's just when you have exhausted a part of the field, you move a few hundred meters, you drill another well, and you go again, and so on and so forth. But when you are on sea, it's absolutely out of question. Each time you have to drill a new well that you build a new platform. Mm-hmm. A new platform which costs a terrific amount of money, which is extremely difficult to settle in high waters, which is a complex steel structure, which weighs maybe 10 times more than the ship, and which is very delicate. So you are obliged from that single spot to have access to the whole field. And this is why the development of the drilling procedures have been extremely important, what is called directional drilling. That means starting from a given point, drilling the well vertical, and then diverting this well in depth so that it can go sidewards at a great distance, sometimes a few miles, to look for the oil at the periphery of the reservoir. It's like some kind like an inverted umbrella with all, you know, those wells diverting all around.
Stick it down when it's closed up and then open it up once it's under.
Exactly.
What kind of depth are we talking about for most of these oil reserves that are under the ocean?
I think we have two depths to consider. The reservoir itself, where the oil sits, which could be generally in the order of 9 to 12,000 feet, sometime deeper, in hard rock, and the depths of the sea on which the platforms are sitting. And that depth of the sea is, of course, by far less. I believe that now we have very few platforms which are sitting in areas with more than 1,000 feet of depth. Which means that the drilling tubes or the lines will have to go through from the platform through the sea for, let's say, 1,000 feet, and then another 10,000 feet in the hard rock, which is under the sea bottom.
How quickly is this technology advancing? One of the things that we have to deal with here is some very harsh weather conditions above the surface of the water, which is not necessarily true in off the coast of Galveston, for example.
So you're perfectly true. This is even the big problem for the development of the North Slope here. It's the fact that the sea is not free. There is a lot of drifting ice. Even you have compact ice on it. And this, the drilling techniques in solid ice or in broken ice are not completely mastered yet. We, until now, have been using some indirect ways to deal with it. For instance, to drill during summertime.
From how long ships. Is that season?
Well, let's say 3 months, let's say, at best.
At best.
Or to the contrary, as they do in Canada, in the Canadian archipelago, to do this in wintertime from solid pack ice. They use the pack ice as a solid ground because that ice is anchored in between the different islands. It's not drifting. They reinforce that ice by spraying some seawater on top. That seawater will freeze, will build a kind of big ice lens. And on this artificial ice island, which is anchored on all sides, they settled the rig and they drill. And they drill from, let's say, February till May. Mm-hmm. And then they have to dismantle everything again, cap the well, and wait for the next season to go on. Or else, as they have done along the Arctic slope and in the Mackenzie Delta, to try in shallow waters to build an artificial island by pulling over there thousands and thousands of tons of gravels and rocks. They can build a solid artificial island not too far from the shore and on this settle the exploitation things. But at that point, we are not yet... We don't yet have the mastership of a technology which would allow us to drill from a platform, anchored or not, into a substantial amount of drifting ice. Many different technologies have been proposed. I have not the slightest doubt that we will find something, but it's a difficult issue.
Does it make that much economic sense at this point? Are we really doing some? Are the oil companies really doing something that is more research, looking toward the future?
I don't believe, with all due respect I have to major corporations, that they would be indulging into research with that amount of money. No, they are really trying to seek for valuable ventures economically. But here we have to be extremely careful when we begin to discuss the assessment of a resource. What does it mean? A resource can only be understood into a given historical and economical context. That means what is a resource today was not maybe yesterday and might not be tomorrow. What was a resource yesterday has disappeared today. Or what is not yet a resource today might be the day after. We were using in the past a lot of wood. Wood has disappeared now more or less as an energy resource from all Europe, still used in a certain number of countries having extended forest. We were not using oil some 1 century ago. It had no significance. Today it has. We were using a massive amount of coal at the turn of century. It dropped down somehow and it's coping back. We'll be using it now. Natural gas will maybe in the future be a big resource. So always a question to know whether at the time you are developing these energy resources, whether the world market makes it economical or not. And in the present circumstances, with a certain amount of overproduction, with the fact that due to a conservation strategy, and maybe more frugality of life in many areas, the energy consumption has been substantially dropping, or at least is controlled, we have some oil in excess, which means that today the development of the Arctic fields looks economically not a very profitable operation. But we know very well that some high tensions will develop again on the energy market in the next 10 years. I attended last year the World Energy Conference in New Delhi, India, a large gathering. We have a few thousand people, a lot of responsible politicians and leaders and people who are really in charge of running the economies of their country, plus a certain number of experts and scientists. And it was clearly seen that the evolution of the world energy market will follow more or less these given lines. The developing countries will use more and more petroleum products because they are not geared for using electricity, hydro projects, or major coal-fired power station.
It's easier to use
It's much easier
products.
Petroleum because it can be shipped anywhere. You can start a petroleum-fueled engine any place. You don't need, you know, long power lines to transfer.
More simplistic technology
more simplistic,
to employ it.
More easy to access, more easy to cut into small pieces so that every single village can have his own deposit. He will not have a single dam for himself.
Is that why we embraced it so quickly?
It may be. It may be. And now this will create this pressure of needs of developing countries, will definitely create a big energy demand for them in petroleum products. Now, at the same time, and curiously enough, the oil-producing countries have also are witnessing a terrific augmentation of their own energy consumption. They were happy some 10 years ago with a couple of camels and a few tents and so on. Now, today, they are building major industries, airlines, power stations, and all kinds of things. And they use all kinds of advanced technology in home appliances, in fancy cities, and things of the like. And it was even felt that by the turn of the century, they would just be in balance with their own production. So which means that if we assume that at the same time there will be a reasonable development of the Western economies, there will be again an energy quench in the next 10 to 15 years. And at that time, those Arctic resources, which are felt to be today too expensive, might be very cheap indeed.
Mm-hmm. It's amazing. Some things seem to be invented just out of the specialness of the way one individual makes connections, but many other things are invented as a result of what seems possible. Obviously, our whole development through the 40s, 50s, and 60s around the automobile became a very suburban kind of organization for our cities and drive-in everything and more and more freeways and a real expansion of the auto industry, which became a real base for our economy, a real barometer of how well our country was doing in terms of our GNP. You see that there are other. You're implying that developing countries are following in that path, even as we see our petroleum worldwide petroleum resources are limited.
I don't believe you can stop the progress, you know, and it's extremely difficult. We are in front of an ever evolving situation, which is a consequence of a general wish of most countries to take responsibilities for their own development and their own development pace. They don't want to be directed one way or another. They wish to do what they want. Second, because of the massive improvement of healthcare and of the control of some of the major diseases which have been almost eradicated, like smallpox. We are killing so many people in the past. And certainly, a better hygiene in most areas, you have a steady increase of the world population and as such of the needs. And if you combine both, that means an increase due to this demographic pressure, and at the same time an increase in energy demand because of a higher standard of living or a more mechanized approach to many problems, then altogether you see the energy consumption worldwide just rising very quickly. If we see, for instance, agriculture, in many countries, traditional agriculture, was mixed cultures. You had in a field many different crops together. In one way, it was good because the farmer had in his backyard and in his fields around his house everything he needed for his family. Mm-hmm. He was, in fact, a kind of little island of isolate. He did not need any kind of outside contact.
In Alaska call subsistence. You can get around what you need to live.
Absolutely. He was on a subsistence type of economy. Now, when that type of agriculture evolved into the development, massive development of standardized crops, soy or alfalfa, or coffee or cocoa or rice or things of the like. And all those fields were turned down into monoculture. And they had only one or two at most of the crops. They discovered, unfortunately, a lot of things. They discovered, A, that with the fields being submitted always to the same type of crop, there was a rapid exhaustion of the lands and of the land facilities to support new growth. Hence, the necessity to apply to fertilizers and to control better the nutrition input to the plant. Then also because of the extension of that agriculture itself, they were obliged to mechanize the agriculture. And hence they were obliged to buy all kinds of motorized equipment to do it, and as such, to import fuel and to import gas or to import material to run this equipment. And they became dependent from outside market, not only because their own crops were not sufficient to feed them, but that they had to sell them outside and as such be part of the world market. And they followed, unfortunately, the fluctuation of this world market. And in the period of depression of a given commodity, they were into serious financial troubles. So which means that many developments which are done nowadays are creating new international problems of interconnection of countries, of interdependence.
And, that we have no present mechanism for dealing with. Acid rain is one of those things that development in one place or a mistake in one place or an unseen negative event in one place can have incredible ramifications for another area.
Well, when you are speaking about acid rains, you are touching upon, of course, a very, very delicate and complex issue, which is a problem of long-distance pollution. Or in other words, long-distance environmental effects of industrial activities which take place in completely different areas. And I believe that we see, not only with acid rains, but we see Arctic haze. We have a typical example of this, you know, this period during winter between December and April, where the clear sky of the north can become rather opaque, with this pervasive Arctic haze, which cuts down the visibility sometimes to a few miles, sometimes 10 to 20 miles, whether it is crystal clear in other periods of the year. And now we have evidence that this aerosol, which is a polluted aerosol, contains soot, contains metals, contains SO2, of course, and nitrogen oxides and all kinds of undesirable components. This is coming from industrial activity over Europe and Western USSR. Has been traveling maybe 12,000 miles over the frozen, dry Arctic Ocean to get deposited or to get stagnant over the northern part of Alaska. Now, who is responsible for this? Can we say to the European industry, you pollute the northern lands of Alaska and do something for this? Would they care about it? Definitely not. And the problem of Arctic acid rain is falling exactly in the same field. It has been very critical and very acute in southern Scandinavia. You understand that a country like Sweden or Norway have about 90% of the deposits of sulfur on their own land, which is coming from foreign origins. So whatever they do with their own industry, they are polluted with those fumes and those things coming on their spot, you know, and making corrosion on their buildings and eating the old monuments and crunching down the forest and killing the lakes and things of the like. That's a very difficult issue. And again, are Germany, Poland, Great Britain, France, Belgium responsible for this? In part, yes. But what are the possibilities? I think the only possibility is that the environmental protection dimension is built into the ethos of our new generations, that they do understand that it is not enough to have a good standard of living, but that the quality of life is as important, and that this is not just something which comes by God's grace. You have to fight for it, and it has a price. You have to pay for it. And if you accept to pay a bit more for electricity, a bit more for energy sources, then you will understand that the processed goods will cost a bit more too. But at the same time, you will assume that the power station, the plants and the urban structures will make the needed effort to clean their air masses, and this problem will fade away.
And that the sort of idiom that it's the world gets smaller and smaller is in fact true, that the things that we're doing have more and more impact farther away, that our interconnectedness is almost unavoidable, or at least increasingly unavoidable. The committee that you're involved with, the work you're involved with, is partially an attempt to address that. It's a circumpolar group.
Yes, a committee which was created in 1979 as a name of Comité Arctique International, International Arctic Committee, and which has its base in Europe, in the Principality of Monaco, for several reasons, is an attempt to create a platform where individual experts, in their private capacity, would be susceptible to discuss complex issues dealing with the development of the Arctic in a friendly, professional atmosphere, and relieved from the pressure of governmental orders or of national policies. It's the reason why we always wanted this to be kept as an informal pool of experts working as a non-governmental organization with non-political goals. And as such, this committee is not involved into strategic matter. It's not involved either into the problems of national policies. Looks, for instance, at the problems of native rights into different communities. It's really an area in which we hope to be able to discuss hard facts without interfering into problems which are obviously of the responsibility of the individual countries concerned.
Obviously, one example of where politics does get involved is the man's interrelatedness to the migratory mammals that we have in this area, and the International Whaling Commission and its decisions are they make an attempt to base those decisions on scientific hard facts, but as we all know, it becomes also very political, and so.
Well, you know, science and politics are closely related today for many reasons, because science has become a very expensive issue. And as such, now science is supported in great part, in major part, by the state budget. And as such, every responsible citizen feels involved into the science policy of his own country. It's no longer something which is done in the backyard of an isolated scholar who is working with his own hands and with his own material. He's dependent from the community, and as such, he has also to report to that community and tell what he is doing with the product of the income tax that he's crunching for his research. So in that way, science and politics are closely correlated. But in the precise case of the United States, I believe that thanks to your constitution, which is a very democratic and very liberal one, everybody who had the possibility or wanted to express his opinion had the facility to do so. And this, I believe, is an extremely important issue. It's not true all around the Arctic Circle, as you do know.
Are there things that other countries around the Arctic Circle are doing well that we might, in Alaska, take a good lesson from?
Well, I believe that Alaska is a country which has been certainly developing very well, and in particular, which has survived, if I can say so, the major growth crisis of the oil period and oil development period, not so badly. And that it was a difficult challenge for this country to get into major operations from the day on into remote areas and try and adapt his social-cultural structures to this, which it did without impairing too much its chances of development in the future. Now, I think a little country, which, to my opinion, may certainly give some interesting working direction, is Iceland. Iceland is a very difficult climate. It's a climate which is very close to the one of certain parts of Alaska. It's a rather sterile soil. It is a soil which has been very unfortunately often covered by volcanic eruptions. And they have developed some kind of interesting agriculture, which to my opinion would be susceptible to be applied in many Alaskan areas. And conversely, some of the Alaska development in agriculture are presenting great interest for the Icelanders. So I believe that there is definitely there a possibility of correlation. Greenland, I would say, is so different as a country from Alaska that I don't believe that the technology or recipes which could be developed for Alaska are immediately applicable to Greenland or vice versa. That's a completely different structure. Mm-hmm. And as also Norway, which is Arctic too, by its geographic location, it's temperate, in fact, as because of its climate and because of the Gulf Stream. Mm-hmm. The seas are ice-free when in Alaska they have been frozen already for a few thousands of miles.
Right. So clearly we have some things that are very much in common, but some things that are very different. And it certainly is good, and I suppose inevitable, that there is much more sharing of information, increasing number of conferences and so on, forums for sharing of information, so we all don't have to invent the wheel separately.
I guess you are perfectly right, and there is nothing to fear of exchanging ideas and information. It's very useful. I think it's one of the beauty of this world is that the communication system has opened many isolated people to the world community. And now they have access to others, and they can explain their problem. They can make some benefit from their experience. And it helps to build also a better international understanding between different countries. And I don't believe we should be driving at a uniform world. That would be the death of all of us. I believe we should keep Florida as it is, and Louisiana as it is, and the Boston area, and Alaska as it is, as it should be. But we should certainly try and share in common our experience and our way of handling problem, because in all these different areas, finally, the methodology is about the same.
And I thank you for being a very articulate and giving messenger that is willing to do some of this traveling around and sharing of this information. It's been very interesting for me, as I hope it has been for our listeners. With me has been visiting distinguished professor Louis Ray. I've been your host, Patty Kostelic. Our executive producer has been Carla Tonella. I hope you'll tune in next week for Home Fires Radio Show. Have a nice afternoon. Thank you.